I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
The clip you just heard was from a recent Bay Area protest against the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, otherwise known by its acronym ICE. Now, in that clip, you could also hear the protesters railing against Palantir. You may be asking, what exactly is Palantir? And if you're a bit of a nerd, you may be thinking it's just a Lord of the Rings reference. The Palantir these protesters are speaking out against, however, is much more real and infinitely scarier than anything that a fantasy writer could ever have imagined. Founded by Peter Thiel, Nathan Gettings, Joe Lonsdale, Stephen Cohen, and Alexander Karp, Palantir Technologies is a private American software company headquartered in Palo Alto, California, that specializes in the increasingly popular and more than arguably Orwellian field of big data analytics. Recently, the company has found itself coming under heavy scrutiny after revelations of its technology's use by ICE. Joining us on this edition of Parallax Views to unpack that story and the broader Orwellian Big Brother ramifications of Palantir is returning guest journalist Eric Dreitzer of Counterpunch. In addition, Eric will tell us a little bit about #29Leaks, a collaboration between Counterpunch, distributed denial of secrets, hacktivist Barrett Brown, and others, which promises to expose the corruption of a scandalous London investment firm. And now, without further ado, my latest conversation with Counterpunch's Eric Dreitzer. Eric Dreitzer, welcome back to Parallax Views.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So, Eric, you have a new article at Counterpunch, one of my favorite alternative media websites. And that article is entitled, Records Show Palantir Made $60 Million Contracting with ICE for Mobile App. I guess where I want to start is, what exactly is Palantir for people who may be living under a rock all this time?
Well, Palantir is a data company that was founded by Peter Thiel and a few other people that he is connected to. Peter Thiel being the billionaire who was an early investor in PayPal and Facebook and a number of other quite lucrative investments that he made that built his fortune. And Thiel went on to found this company, Palantir, along with a guy named Alexander Karp and I think a few others. And basically the idea was to develop a software company that would be able to aggregate large amounts of data and be able to filter through and process that data in the post 9/11 space. If we remember, of course, that immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was much talk about all of the data and all of the different agencies and how they couldn't speak to each other. And there was no way to really, truly track the movements of millions of people and on and on and on. And from that period, that post 9/11 period, Palantir, as well as other companies, it must be said, were kind of birthed. And Palantir has since then grown to be one of the, I think, big players in the security and surveillance space. They don't do security and surveillance, at least not overtly. But what they do is they provide the tools to those agencies that do those things. So they'll provide the software applications and the technical expertise and the know-how to be able to actually filter through massive amounts of data, find the relevant pieces of information, and so forth. So Palantir has grown to be a major player, actually crowding out some of the formerly dominant players in that private contracting space. They are now one of the principal contractors with the U.S. government, boasting contracts with all sorts of agencies, ranging from the CIA to the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, and a number of other agencies as well. And as I note in the article, focusing just on ICE, Palantir has made a tremendous amount of money contracting with ICE, and I assume we'll probably go into a little bit more detail, but the point here being that Palantir is intimately involved in the large-scale, what we would call big data surveillance machine.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's in the name itself, Palantir. That's taken from it's taken from Lord of the Rings. It's like an object, I think, in Lord of the Rings that allows the person that has it to sort of see what's going on in other parts of the world.
That's exactly right, and I'm glad you brought it up, because it's something that has been discussed as well, that there's sort of maybe two or three possible meanings to the name, and but we don't need to go into that. But yes, it is about being able to see through the numbers, to see through the data, and to find the relevant information. And it's actually quite frightening when you get into the nuts and bolts of what they're able to do, and projecting in your mind what they must be working on these days. It's quite chilling.
And real quick, I wanted to, maybe before we get into the main sort of the meat of the story, when it comes to Peter Thiel, I notice a lot of people either know him because of, his involvement in the Hulk Hogan Gawker trial. You know, there's that whole tabloid side to the Peter Thiel story. And I think people also know of him as a sort of libertarian, right? And I mean, he described himself in an article for Cato, the Cato Institute, as a libertarian, but he used the term libertarian in quotes. And he said in that same article that he no longer believes that freedom and democracy are compatible. Thiel does not seem like what most people think of when they think of, the libertarians. It almost seems like he's even farther off the beaten path than even libertarians are.
I think that's true in a sense, and I suppose it depends on how you how you perceive libertarianism and what libertarianism really is. I think that if you conceive of libertarianism as a political ideology with a defined worldview and one that is clear and in favor of free markets to the radical extreme and on and on, the way that we typically think of right-wing libertarianism in the United States, where the word libertarian means something somewhat unique in the world. But if you think of libertarianism as being that sort of an ideology, then yes, I think that Peter Thiel is probably outside of the norm. But I think that actually libertarianism in the United States, and certainly in the last few years, it's really become something other than an ideology. I think it's really just become sort of a catch-all term, a sort of a political other. It is a grab bag. It is a term that people appropriate for themselves when they don't want to use the terminology that is correct and appropriate. For instance, a number of outright fascists in the United States call themselves libertarians, Augustus Sol Invictus being a prime example of that trend. I mean, these are outright Nazi fascist types. They believe in all sorts of extreme fascist ideology, and yet they appropriate, or maybe I think quite neatly fit into the big tent of libertarianism. So in that sense, I'm not sure what the word even means, but Peter Thiel is certainly in that bizarre milieu.
Almost like, I've often thought of him as almost like this sort of techno-feudalist.
Yeah, I think I called him a techno-goblin in my article, something along those lines. It's been said that he does, what does he, feed off of the blood of teenagers? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, he's one of those people that you almost don't know where the line exactly is between, you know, the tall tales and the reality.
Yeah, he's into the whole, I think you're referring to the whole life extension through blood transfusion. I mean, he's almost like a supervillain out of a comic book.
But you know, I got to tell you, like, those are the things about Thiel that are even slightly endearing. You know what I mean? Like, when you talk about these sort of oddball things that he's really interested in, life extension and conquering death being one of those, I find that incredibly interesting, quite frankly. The problem is that Peter Thiel doesn't actually use his billions in the pursuit of some sort of higher calling or some sort of, you know, utopian future for humanity. In fact, he applies his billions in deeply repressive and coercive ways. And in fact, I think he's one of the chief architects of an incredibly dangerous and quite scary overarching surveillance state that really couldn't exist without Thiel and Palantir in 2019.
Well, the only other thing I will say about Thiel is that that quote that he doesn't think liberty and democracy are compatible. I always found that very, very chilling, because it really highlights his, I think he has a disdain for what he sees as, you know, the plebs, you know?
So, absolutely. Yeah. 100%. I mean, that in that regard, he's a perfect avatar of the ruling class in 2019, right? I mean, not only does he have a disdain for the plebs, I think that he almost views them as a sub race. That subhuman, right? That or you know, almost a Nietzschean kind of Untermensch versus Übermensch sort of mentality, which actually fits quite neatly in with both fascism and what we might call right-wing libertarianism in the U.S.
Well, you know, what sort of led to Thiel's company Palantir coming under fire recently? I know our mutual friend Barrett Brown, the sort of hacktivist, as people call him, has been, you know, covering Palantir for a long time, but it seems like now the mainstream media is sort of catching up. What led to that?
A number of things, I think. First and foremost, Palantir got some unwanted attention, I think, because Peter Thiel really came out as probably the most vocal, ardent, and public supporter of Donald Trump from Silicon Valley. In that regard, he really set himself apart from a lot of his fellow billionaire parasites in the Bay Area, in that he not only did he support Donald Trump, he publicly supported Donald Trump to the point of giving a keynote address at the Republican National Convention. I mean, becoming a major figure within the mainstream of the Republican Party. So I think that alone thrust Palantir into the spotlight in a way that it might not have been previously. And then, of course, also the fact that Palantir is deeply connected to all of the immigration policies, or rather immigration policy enforcement that we're seeing now. The tracking of individuals for the purposes of removal, that, of course, dovetails with the ICE movement, or rather ICE and the Abolish ICE movement, which, of course, puts Thiel and Palantir into the spotlight. And I think also it has to do with the growth of big data. I mean, big data is now the it is the frontier in the world. It is, I guess, akin to what energy might have been for the Industrial Revolution. Data is the lifeblood of the 21st century global economy and global political order. And in that regard, Palantir has really become one of maybe the two or three dominant players in the big data space, at least as it comes to the processing and aggregation of data. So I think that there's a number of factors, sort of a confluence of factors, that really thrust Thiel and Palantir into the spotlight. And I think obviously the Trump connection is a big one.
Well, I mean, he hasn't even backed down on the Trump stuff. I mean, he was just at, I believe he was involved in that recent social media summit for this sort of addressing Silicon Valley and where the conservative movement in America needs to go from here. So he's still involved in that.
Those are two different events. It wasn't the social media summit, which was at the White House. It was actually I don't remember the actual title of the event, but it was basically the future of nationalism, right? And that it was a conference that was organized by right wing Israeli, academic, I believe, and, a number of, prominent figures from the far right in the United States, including, from the University of Penn, Wax. I believe Amy Wax, or Wax is her last name, I think. A number of prominent racists and pseudo and maybe not so pseudo fascists spoke there. And Peter Thiel gave probably the most memorable speech of all, in that he named Google as basically involved in treason, because he essentially accused Google of collaboration with the Chinese government. So you can see how Thiel in many ways acts as sort of an amplifier of a lot of Trump's rhetoric.
And also, I want to note that Palantir is getting a lot of attention now for its involvement with ICE, but they've been involved in policing with, I guess, the NYPD and LAPD as well, right?
Oh, that's exactly right. And that's something that I talk about in that article that you noted. Part of the story here is that Palantir is not, let me rephrase this. Palantir would like to present itself as a software development company, as a company that merely develops the tools, right? That they're not actually involved in the application of these tools, right? It's similar to, the guillotine maker, you know what I mean? I don't know, the hangman or something, right? So the idea being that Palantir, they don't make any judgments about their customers. They're just a vendor selling software. But the reality is, as you noted, that not only are they providing the software as documented by WNYC in a very important expose earlier in July of 2019, they're actually intimately involved in the day-to-day operation and application of these programs. There are emails that were revealed to show direct collaboration down to the day-to-day mission and operational integrity of the app itself. And I'm talking about the app known as Falcon. So there were more than $60 million in contracts to Palantir from ICE just for Falcon. That's one app. One product that Palantir sells for the app and for the operation and maintenance of that app. In other words, if you're some investigator, some cop in LA or in New York, you can literally be on the phone with somebody at Palantir walking you through the way to optimize the use of the app in order to get whatever the target might be. That kind of collaboration, that's something that is Well, that's something that was never publicly acknowledged until very recently, and I think that's part of the problem for Palantir's PR image.
And I believe that expose was from WNYC, correct?
That's right, WNYC, I want to say first or second week of July 2019.
So maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit more about the Falcon app and what it does, what it's sort of used for, the intention behind it.
So basically, if you can imagine law enforcement, you know, in this case with Falcon, we're talking about the LAPD and the NYPD, right? So it's the two biggest, most advanced, most well-funded police departments in the country, maybe in the world, I don't know. And basically what they have are any number, I don't know, maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen, maybe three dozen databases with all sorts of different information, whether it's identifying information, information about financial records, information about immigration history, whatever it may be, many different databases. Part of the problem was always that it was very labor intensive and time consuming to be able to search through these different databases. And what Palantir did was developed a mobile application called Falcon that basically allows an individual cop to search through all of those databases simultaneously and instantaneously through basically like a fusion of these different databases that Palantir is able to access. So what that means then is that even with just a snippet of information, maybe a first name and a partial address or a nickname and a license plate number or whatever it may be, these cops are able to synthesize information from a number of different databases from very scant personal details to develop profiles on everything from consumption habits to daily work routines to marital status and all kinds of different things. In other words, they're able to not only track down and locate, but develop an entire clear personal picture and profile of a target from almost no information. Just as one example, if you drive on the streets of New York City, you have a very good likelihood of having your license plate scanned by a license plate reader that is mounted on an NYPD vehicle. Now, that license plate reader has now placed a little pin on the map saying that my car was in this location at this specific time. Now, multiply that by millions upon millions of times all over the country, all the time. And what you have then is the ability to be able to access almost real time the movements of an individual that you may not even be tracking in a formal way. That's the power of Palantir and of Palantir's products, and that's the power that they put into the hands of these fascist cops.
And, you know, I want to look at the relationship here between ICE and Palantir. You know, I want to let my listeners know, you just did a really great interview with Arun Gupta. Is it Gupta or Gupta?
Arun Gupta.
Arun Gupta, yeah, from the No More Concentration Camps movement, that sort of really just gives a clear overview of just the extent of what ICE is doing. And I think more and more we're seeing the horrendous treatment, the separation, and just all of these other things going on with ICE. So I would really recommend listeners check that out as well.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it. Yeah, Arun is, I would say, one of the best couple journalists that are working in the United States today. He's published all over the place in mainstream and non-mainstream. He is great, and I'm really happy to work with him on the No More Concentration Camps, No More Concentration Camps Facebook page, nomorecamps.org.
So, again, listeners really should check that out just to get more of an insight into what ICE is doing and just all the legal aspects and whatnot. So in regards to this Falcon app and the relationship with Palantir and ICE, I guess Palantir is saying, well, you know, we just create the software. They're going into damage control mode. Why do you think that they're, you know, sort of being dishonest about that, maybe.
Well, come on. I mean, we know this. You've seen it. If you follow social media or even legacy media, you've seen there is a burgeoning movement in this country against Trump's immigration policies and against all of those corporations that are benefiting from it. We've seen walkouts from workers at Wayfair. We've seen protests in major events at Amazon. Amazon, of course, being one of the primary collaborators, both with data services and other things that they provide to ICE. We've seen a number of examples of activists engaging in direct action at times to raise awareness around this collaboration between the immigration and enforcement system and big tech. This is something that has been kind of ongoing. And if you've seen a number of the social justice oriented struggles against big tech, for instance, the fight against Amazon here in New York is a prime example. You see that there is an increasing awareness of just how pivotal the role of big tech is in the ongoing, you know, police state, surveillance state, carceral state, all the different states that it is these days. Yeah, I think that Palantir is suffering from a PR problem, and also the fact that Palantir, I think, feels that perhaps this was a mistake. I think that there's probably a tendency to question whether or not they should have taken these contracts because it potentially puts other contracts in danger. We've certainly seen other examples of industries that perhaps have overplayed their hand. There's rumblings that the private for-profit prison companies are rethinking some of their engagement with some of these detention facilities and so forth. So there's the pushback against these policies and those corporations benefiting from the policies, I think, has been significantly more than maybe they bargained for. And good. Anything that keeps Thiel and Karp at night is good by me.
Well, so, I mean, are ICE's current operations even, would they even be possible without Falcon and Palantir?
Yes, they would be possible, but they would be even more ineffective. They would basically what ICE would be doing would be the same thing that ICE was doing 15 years ago, 17 years ago when it was created after 9/11. I mean, essentially, ICE would be, you know, working on tips, I guess, basic kind of law enforcement style tactics, et cetera, things like that. I don't think that they would be able to kind of have the, you know, targeted raid operations like they're doing now. I think that is very much thanks to the use of data and companies like Palantir. Of course, Palantir is not the only one, but Palantir is getting a lot of the attention now, and that's the information that's come out.
Right. I think the way you put it is the speed and scope of ICE's operations would be much more limited if it wasn't for the Falcon app and Palantir.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be targeted in quite the same way. For instance, I mean, it's inescapable if you look at the reality of what ICE is doing that this is not just an anti-immigrant policy. This is a policy of ethnic cleansing. They are specifically targeting black and brown immigrants and those communities and avoiding targeting any of the white undocumented people in this country. So there is a racial and an ethnic component to that. And Palantir software makes that even easier to draw those distinctions.
And, you know, of course, the other aspect of this is that this is not where the Palantir story of corruption and just, you know, very spooky sort of activity starts. I mentioned Barrett Brown earlier. In the article, you mention something called Team Themis. Maybe you could tell my listeners just a little bit about that and its targeting of dissidents.
Sure. So you mentioned Barrett Brown. Barrett's a journalist, was working with Anonymous in 2011, 2012, that time period. And one of the things, among many, that they were able to reveal through the leaking of, well, the hack of the emails of H.B. Gary, what was H.B. Gary Federal, a private government contractor, one that is involved in all sorts of security operations and various things with the U.S. government and private clients, one of the most well-known in the world, in fact. And when that information was leaked, one of the things that came out of that leak that Barrett, with some of his colleagues, were able to break in The Guardian and in other publications was an attempt by essentially a consortium of these three companies, Barrico, Palantir, and H.B. Gary, and these companies were going to collaborate to create what was called Team Themis, which would basically be, I guess you could call it, a semi-autonomous consortium of operators whose job was to intimidate, suppress, and otherwise coerce any opposition against their clients, in particular their clients being the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and people like Glenn Greenwald, who was specifically mentioned in some of the leaked information. They were high on the target list, as were activists and labor organizers and their families. And so what we saw and what Barrett and his associates were able to document and break back in 2011 was the fact that Palantir, like H.P. Gary and these other companies, was not simply providing software, was not simply a data company, but rather was over, I guess you could say, crossed the line into espionage operations and surveillance and the kind of work that you do not associate with a software development company out of Silicon Valley. So what we saw even a decade ago was that Palantir was already on the road to being much more than the company it presents itself as. Rather, Palantir was already on the road to becoming an integral part of the, I guess you could say, the new composition of the security, surveillance, military state.
Palantir's products are being used in corporate headquarters, as you note in the article, U.S. military, intelligence. I mean, this has become a massive, just secondary surveillance network, as you quote, big data surveillance, the case of policing. In that study, they literally refer to Palantir as something of a secondary surveillance network. This is the Orwellian Big Brother come to life.
Yeah, exactly. And what's really terrifying, and I didn't even get into this in the article, but I'll bring it up since we're just talking it through here, is that what we're talking about here and what we know about Palantir's operations, this is already old news. One has to wonder, what is Palantir doing right now, today, in their offices, now that we're in the age of artificial intelligence and machine learning? What are they doing with the advanced cutting edge technologies? What are they doing with blockchain? How is that fitting into their new software that they're developing, their new ideas for data and so forth? I mean, it's difficult to wrap your head around what it would look like to have an all-encompassing secondary surveillance system throughout the entire country, and it's operated by artificial intelligence. What's that going to, what's that, what kind of a system does that create?
Well, it's sort of like Bentham's Panopticon.
Right, and I think I even made that reference in the article, that it is very much Bentham's Panopticon, but there's something, I think that people haven't even really begun to try to wrap their heads around that reality. What a reality of artificially intelligent, all-encompassing surveillance is going to look like, because that reality is not only likely, I think sadly at this point, the way things are going, it's inevitable.
I mean, if we can speculate here, what do you think that would look like?
What do I think that – I think it could look like everything from predictive policing being probably one of the primary examples of that, using advanced algorithms that are dynamic and changing every millisecond to be able to synthesize, you know, hundreds of millions of data points within a very, you know, within a fraction of a second, to be able to develop models for maybe geographic locations where a crime will be committed, who might commit that crime, and so forth. I mean, I hate to immediately go to like a dystopian sci-fi world.
So it's like something out of Philip K. Dick.
It's Minority Report. I mean, that is exactly the premise of Minority Report, and there is an element of fiction to that picture that I'm painting. But somehow I feel that we've entered into a stage of history where it's not really clear what's fiction and what's not anymore. I think that, fake news is a perfect example of that, with living in the world of unreality. And I think increasingly we're going to need to begin to reckon with the idea that artificial intelligence and machine learning is going to take the kinds of repressive technologies that we've all been struggling against and take them to new and truly disturbing places.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Palantir even pops up, I guess, in the Cambridge Analytica story with the 2016 election. I mean, it's a rabbit hole.
Oh, they're involved in everything. That's a direct connection. And actually, I think thank you for bringing it up. I think it's an important point to mention. Palantir was involved, and this comes from Chris Wiley, who was the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower who testified to the UK, to the parliament in the UK. Palantir was involved with SCL Group, involved with Cambridge Analytica's parent company. They were directly involved in providing data that was providing the tools that were used to scrape the Facebook data that was then fed into the Cambridge Analytica models, which were used for the purposes of Brexit and, most importantly, Donald Trump. In many ways, this whole Russiagate saga has been kind of interesting and really quite illuminating, because as people have been chasing the Russian white rabbit, down proverbial rabbit holes, we found that in fact Donald Trump himself is not so much a product of a Russian meddling operation, although there may be some element of that too, but rather Donald Trump is a product of a Cambridge Analytica Palantir Facebook meddling operation. Because in fact, what you find is that there's nothing authentic about the way in which Cambridge Analytica used that data, the way in which Palantir's tools were used to essentially manufacture Trump's victory through, I think at the most generous illegitimate means, if not utterly and outright criminal means. So yeah, Palantir is involved in everything. Palantir is part of the reason we have Trump, and Palantir is enabling and collaborating with Trump. And so yeah, they're fucking villains.
And it's monetized, as you put it. This is surveillance capitalism on steroids.
Oh, exactly right. Exactly right. $60 million from ICE is nothing to drop in the Palantir bucket. You're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts every year. It's interesting, because if you read about Palantir, you keep finding how they're not profitable, how, they wanted to do an IPO at an valuation of $9 billion, then it was reduced to $7 billion. And they keep talking about how Palantir is not turning enough of a profit. And then you start looking in through their financial records and through government financial records, and you find hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts. So it's an interesting operation Thiel's got going.
Well, and the other line I really liked in your article was, if there's a data point, chances are Palantir has it stored or can access it. That's a scary thought.
100%. Guys, I mean, really think about it. How many cameras are you passing any given day? You don't even know, because you don't even see most of them, right? Now imagine if each of those cameras was essentially developing thousands upon thousands of data points every hour as hundreds upon hundreds of people walk in front of it. And that's just one camera in one place. Now think about all of the mobile phones. Now think about the smart TVs, the computers, every other internet connected device, your credit cards, everything. Everything is a data point. That's what I said. That's what I was saying earlier, that we are into the era of big data. And when we say era of big data, we need to think of data not as just, you know, this thing that operates behind the scenes. Data as a resource. Data as a resource as vital as water or oil in previous eras. That is the power and significance of data. And those who wield the data wield the power.
Well, you know, beginning to wrap up here, I always say that I want to end on a positive note. That's becoming very, very hard these days with all the news we're getting. But, you know, do you think there are any sort of modes of resistance to this sort of emerging just Orwellian Big Brother come to life?
Well, 100%. Absolutely. There's innumerable methods of resistance. Direct action is very powerful. I mean, you and I are sitting here talking about Palantir having a PR crisis. Why do they have a PR crisis? Because tens of thousands of people are active and mobilizing around these issues and are putting Palantir in the spotlight, putting the pressure on them. Absolutely. You can undermine their business model. You can make it difficult for them to operate. You can force them to change their tactics, to drop certain contracts, to modify, you know, maybe scale back what they're trying to do. There's any number of things that we can be doing. And of course, and probably the most important point of all is that anything is better than nothing. I mean, that's the idea, is that if we're not resisting against these people, they're just going to build it all. They're going to build it all out, and they're going to do it whether they hear from us or not. And so the responsibility that we have is to gum up the gears, as it were, to make it impossible for them to operate, to force them into the light of day. That's from the, you know, grassroots social movement activist perspective. I think that there's also absolutely governmental ways that this can be reined in. I think it's absolutely critical that if the next president is Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, that they move forward immediately with legislation to ban things like facial recognition, to ban other technologies that really, I think, are not only a slippery slope, but in fact offer power to those forces that would use it to build out the totalitarian state. I think that ultimately that is a real danger. And when you look at how quickly, just a few years, we've gone from, you know, people debating what Donald Trump was to seeing the overt and outright fascist operation in full force out in the open in the light of day. I mean, I think it should be a wake-up call for people to just how quick all of this can happen, all of it can be done. So yeah, I think that there are governmental solutions as well, facial recognition being one example, but you could get creative. I mean, you could talk about a Bill of Rights with regard to data. I think that's an important question. Do we have a right to privacy of our data in the modern age, especially in an age where we're moving into a 5G reality with an Internet of Things, where everything, every object that you interact with is internet connected, internet ready, wirelessly connected, and so forth? I mean, as we enter into that reality, what are our perceptions of privacy? What do we think these companies should be able to do? Should the government even be able to contract with a company like this for this kind of technology? As far as I'm concerned, everything is in play and everything needs to be tried, because truly, these companies like Palantir, among others, these companies, they really are, if not, as I said in the article, it's not that they're paving the way for the fascist state. They're already building it, and it's already here.
And, you know, I just want to add to that. I mean, we have a president now that is basically actively saying that he wants, you know, anti-fascist dissidents to be categorized as terrorists. And, you know, we're really feeling the heat now, I think, in a lot of ways. And in regards to Palantir and a lot of this malfeasance on the part of big data, big tech, Silicon Valley, I think we need to be very careful on the left not to allow, the right-wing fascist forces out there to capture the critique of Silicon Valley, which is sort of what people like Tucker Carlson are doing now. They're trying to sort of make that their own thing, like, oh, we're the ones against big tech. I think the left can't allow that at this point.
Yeah, I don't see them being able to really co-opt that. I think that the idea of a sort of Ron Paul liberty, blah, 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 whatever, I think that's pretty dead at this point. I mean, look at Rand Paul. Rand Paul was a pretty good barometer of just how palatable those politics were. And Rand Paul has gone fully fascist in the last 18 months. Rand Paul is making overtly and truly despicably racist statements about Ilhan Omar literally today. We're recording on, what is it, July 29th. So Rand Paul has jettisoned any pretense of, you know, civil libertarian conservative, pro-privacy, pro-Bill of Rights, pro-Constitution politics in favor of a full embrace of Trumpism. Now, that is supposedly one of the quote-unquote principled right-wing Republicans. So, no, I don't believe that the right is really going to be able to co-opt resistance against big tech. If anything, what the right did was quite the opposite. And the single biggest fight and victory against big tech probably in the last 10 years just happened in the fight against Amazon here in New York. And who did the right immediately blame? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She was immediately tarred and feathered with having destroyed the Amazon deal, even though, you know, she basically put out a few tweets and there were a number of activist groups on the ground who were doing all of the legwork. But she was the one who was tied to that, right? The idea that the left, these commies, these socialists, that they are just so anti-business, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I don't need to lay it all out. I think that that's a much more likely scenario. And frankly, big tech is also associated with a lot of other deeply right-wing trends that people on the left can identify as destructive. I think the obvious one being gentrification. Big tech is 100% the perpetrator of gentrification in places like Seattle and in the Bay Area. Big tech is deeply connected to real estate speculation, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that big tech is increasingly going to be in the spotlight. Facebook and Google and Palantir and all of the rest of them are going to increasingly be seen for the villains that they are.
Well, you know, I think Counterpunch is doing a really great job pushing back against these villains. And just real quick before you go, Counterpunch is now in a partnership with the previously mentioned Barrett Brown, hashtag 29Leaks. Maybe you could tell my listeners just a little bit about that, maybe a quick overview of what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, we at Counterpunch, we've partnered with a number of organizations. Barrett Brown, of course, being, the one we mentioned already, Distributed Denial of Secrets, and Emma Best, at NatSecGeek on Twitter. She is, probably one of the leading FOIA, terrorists, you know, in the country. And then representatives from a number of other, outlets, including the Columbia Journalism Review and the Daily Dot and Daily Beast and I think somebody from CNN and a few other people from a number of different agencies that are good reporters that know how to go through data are going to have access to, I mean, the word is a treasure trove. It's a treasure trove of information. This is leaked information from a place called Formations House. Now, Formations House is in London. It exists at a place. The address is 29 Harley Street, hence the hashtag 29Leaks. And what Formations House is basically a private company that exists for the purposes of creating companies. And so anybody anywhere in the world who wants to create a company that is in the UK can pay Formations House to basically create a company for them. And one of the primary products or selling points of Formations House is that they also have what are called shelf companies, not shell companies, which I think we're all familiar with, but shelf companies, which basically means a ready-made company that you can literally purchase. In other words, you purchase the name, you purchase the paper that it's written on, you purchase the name to include as the director of the company and so forth. It's like a ready-made, you know, cookie cutter company that you can just, you know, slap on to whatever project you need to include it for. So, this is what Formations House is. It's basically a company that makes companies on behalf of people all over the world. But here's the issue. Formations House is not simply a company that makes companies. It is, in fact, a nexus of international money laundering, of international criminal organizations that use the UK and use this service to essentially hide their assets behind an intricate web of shell companies and dummy companies based in places like the Seychelles and in Liechtenstein and other places that have laws against disclosing individual names. And so basically what we're talking about here is hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of gigabytes of emails and data and Excel spreadsheets and all kinds of things that will yield an incredible wealth of information about all types of unsavory characters all over the world. The Formations House was covered in The Guardian in 2018, as it relates to former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych, because in his trial, it had come out that some of the corrupt dealings that he was involved in, the money was being routed through a place called Formations House in the UK. That came out in court filings in Ukraine, and that is a perfect example of what this place really is. This is where the big time gangsters and criminals go to hide their money. And so what we're going to do is we're going to make sure that everybody knows about it.
So it's more or less a tax shelter.
Yes, but it is, but it's more than just a tax shelter, because it's like a full service company creation, you know, one-stop shop. If that makes sense. So just in some of the initial emails that I've looked at, and that's just, you know, just scratching the surface, you'll have people from all over the world sending their documents, right? Their identification documents, and then wiring money, you know, whatever the amount of money might be, to register the company. And here's who I want is to be listed as the director. And here's what the name of the company needs to be. And what you find is the more you dig, the more you find illicit actors all over the world using this place as a way of hiding their money, not hiding their money in Formations House, but hiding their money in fictitious entities created by Formations House.
Well, I gotta say, it sounds like huge news. I mean, the acquisition of these leaked emails, phone calls, faxes, and other documents is said to be around 85 gigabytes, folks. So this is going to be, you know, pretty wild.
Oh, yeah. And like I said, we're just beginning to scratch the surface. You can look for stories coming out of these leaks. It's going to be in Counterpunch, hopefully on a semi-regular basis over the next weeks, months. There's a lot that we don't know, and there's a lot to be written.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Anything you want to add? Anything in the works with you or Counterpunch?
Well, Counterpunch Radio, the podcast that I do in partnership with Counterpunch, always available. You can check that out. And all of my work is available to subscribers on Patreon. You can subscribe for $5 a month. We'll give you full access to all of the content. That's additional podcasts, as well as essays, articles, poetry, photography, random musings, all kinds of stuff is in there. If you like and appreciate my work and the work I do on Counterpunch, check me out on Patreon. It's patreon.com/Eric Dratzer.
Okay, thanks again, Eric Dratzer, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I know Eric and I covered some pretty frightening ground, but I nonetheless hope you found our conversation educational. Parallax Views is looking to get back into the Patreon game a little bit more regularly. It's been difficult keeping up with Patreon and having to monetize the podcast. It's a difficult schedule. But rest assured, Parallax Views is coming back in full force. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.